You're listening to Classic Business with Michael Avery, brought to you by Altron, there when it matters.
Well, the Classic Business Show is brought to you by Altron, technology partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit altron.com. Altron, there when it matters. Well, welcome to our roundtable discussion this evening. And we're tackling the current trade wars and what could be next for globalization. Joining me for this is Dr. Adrian Saville. He's the CEO of Canon Asset Managers. Brooke Spector, former US diplomat in Africa and East Asia and associate editor at the Daily Maverick. And George Friedman, chairman of Geopolitical Futures. Since post-war, globalization has allowed for the sharing of ideas, know-how and markets. In many cases, this was a success story of many large corporates today. This, though, now seems to be in question, with a then leader in globalization now leading the way in protectionism. This is something which was unheard of only a couple of years ago. Surely all of this can't just be about the Chinese profiting from American IP. Adrian, let's start with you this evening. Do you think there's more to these trade wars than just the Chinese stealing some American ideas?
I suspect it's got a lot to do with a sluggishness in economic growth and a maturing in some of the more advanced markets, where you've seen a particular gain in nationalist sentiment. And so I think going on behind this, with aging populations, with slowing growth, is a sort of as an ossification or fossilization of views. And increasingly conservative and increasingly inward-looking. And, you know, it's very easy in those, well, it's easier, perhaps, let me know, it's very easy, but it's easier in those types of circumstances to play to an audience who is willing and receptive. And so you've got a group of recipients who are more easily converted. And I suspect that going on behind the political narrative is also a demographic and economic narrative.
Brooks, let's bring you in here. Your take on why the trade wars are happening. Why is there something that that maybe you can add that maybe other people haven't thought about?
Well, I don't know whether it's something that's original with me. I suspect pretty much every base has been covered by commentators and, you know, all kinds of places. But I think there's some key points to remember. One, the American business complaint, and to some degree the government's complaint, about the way in which the Chinese have gone about obtaining patented information, intellectual property, and the kind of interlinking between the government, state banks, and corporations, and the kind of regulations that are imposed on foreign companies operating in China has generated a fair amount of discontent. You add that together with the indisputable truth that there is a massive trade imbalance as far as the Americans are concerned vis-a-vis China, and then you add that further to the point that was alluded to by your first speaker, that demographically there are people in the U.S. who feel that they are benefiting less from a globalized global economy than they should, and that somehow this has all been unfairly put together. You bring all those things in one place, and then you have a fairly receptive and ready and an audience ripe for cheering on the idea of putting it to the Chinese. One of the things that fascinates me is that we've seen this before. Dial back 20 years ago, and we saw almost exactly the same kind of conversation vis-a-vis the United States and Japan. And it was even the focus of popular novels and films. I haven't seen too many films about Chinese trade issues yet, but I guess maybe they're coming too. What this all means when you take it together is that it's not going to just go away if 20 guys sit around the table and sign a 1,000-page document that changes the structure of this. It's part of the larger globalized economy, and you can't wish it away. You buy anything, and it's the component parts have been made in country A and sent to country B, and perhaps perhaps the semi-finished product has crossed three or four national boundaries along the way, and even products made in China by Chinese companies that are core elements to the 5G networks that are being put together are still using integrated circuits and chips that come from American companies. And so, you know, people just can't get a hold of how this has happened. And so we're stuck with globalization, and we're stuck with the discontents about it.
Let's bring you in here, George. George Fredman, tell us what is your take on the whole thing?
Now, globalism is not the alternative to protectionism. Protectionism sets rules on how the global system works. The global system remains in place. I mean, there will be trade between the United States and China. The problem the United States has is, in the case of China and other countries, is that it's been systematically locked out of access to these. So China has enjoyed free trade with the United States. The United States has not had it. And it's been done in informal ways. It has been done through what Americans think are currency manipulation and a range of things. The Chinese are net exporters. They survive off of exports. They are a essential part of their economy. And they can't afford to allow that to slip. In 2008, they faced a massive crisis. It slipped. The amount of money they were making from exports declined because their customers couldn't buy. And the Chinese became more aggressive in using various tools to maximize their revenue. And this is understandable. But what's not understood in the rest of the world is there are minor groups that have suffered from this. In the United States, say, major segment of the population, the industrial working class, have either lost their jobs or lost part of their income. In other words, what is not understood is that free trade is lovely, but it has political consequences. And what the world is experiencing now is the United States political system can no longer endure the cost it was paying because free trade is distributed unequally. Large corporations benefited from it in the United States. The workers and industries that were devastated did not. So the economy does not live in a vacuum. And GDP does not tell you how well you're doing. The economy lives in a political system, and the question is, how is the GDP distributed? And one of the things that happened not only in the United States, but also in Europe and other advanced countries, is growing inequality and the inability of previously wealthy classes to make a living. So what is surprising to me is that anybody thought the situation could continue unchanged. The Chinese had ample opportunity to gracefully make adjustments in the system. The Obama administration demanded it. It didn't happen. And suddenly we find ourselves in a situation where the United States acted unilaterally, and it seems unreasonable. The period in which the United States will simply accept free trade relations with all countries, and we did with Japan, and we went on with it for quite a while. It's a failure. China cannot be both the second largest economy in the world and have one set of rules it expects to be treated by and other set of rules in which it will treat other countries.
So, George, let me stay with you before I go to the other two guests here. I mean, on the one side, what I'm hearing you saying is that it's all very well and fine to have free trade areas and free trade agreements and so on, but when one party benefits more than the other, then this basically creates these imbalances, and it obviously creates the nationalism back home because there's people that have lost jobs and people that are being left out in the cold. Are we then saying that potentially if we have synchronized global growth right across the world, it's easier to have a free trade agreement rather than being protectionist? Because when we have sporadic growth, which has really been the case since, which has been the case since 2008, all of a sudden we're sitting in a situation where free trade doesn't necessarily treat everybody equally. Are we saying that?
Well, we're saying that sporadic growth, unequal growth, is in the nature of things. China, at its level of economic development, is vastly different from the United States. And the second thing is I'm denying that we've had free trade. When you look at the European Union, they speak of free trade, but so many things are controlled in different ways, particularly agricultural products, that when the Americans look at that market from within the framework of Europe itself, it's a very highly managed trade. The United States is relatively open on the question of trade with the United States in the post-war period. The Chinese have been rigorously free trade in their own sense. So it's not that we have two sides that have been engaged in free trade. The American charge is that the Chinese have prevented free trade, blocking American exports, having informal rules and regulations on what will be done, and that we're just no longer prepared to tolerate it. Now, if the entire world could grow at the same rate, yeah, that would perhaps make a difference. But it doesn't, and it won't, because South Africa is in a different situation than England. England is a different situation than Paraguay, and these will have different needs and dynamics. But I think it's very important to understand that there's a myth about free trade. In the EU, much of it is managed. Much of the rules are set. And most important, the currency, the euro, is defined by political means. I mean, it tends to be what is in favor of Germany and not in favor of Greece. And therefore, I think we really need to move away from both the concept of globalization. We've been globalized since the 16th century when the Europeans went to the Western Hemisphere, and also free trade. EU is not a free trade zone in its fullest sense of the term. China is certainly not a free trade country in terms of imports. Well, we have to understand that each country is going to manage trade to their benefits. South Africa does, China has, and now the United States has become more aggressive in this.
Adrian, let's bring you back into the conversation here. As these trade agreements are hammered out, and as the markets reflect on all these things, I'm seeing that the African continent is trying to sign a free trade agreement. As a matter of fact, it's coming into being in the next couple of weeks. We've almost seen parts of the world happy with what seems to be free trade, and other parts of the world, presumably North America, now America, I'm talking about the United States, not necessarily, you know, wanting to potentially write, new trade agreements. Are we potentially, what is the ultimate outcome of this? Is this a new world order potentially taking shape?
Before you put that question to me, I was trying to jump up and down and helicopter something in on George's observation.
Oh, sorry, I can't see you. So please do tell us.
And that was, I think it strikes me that 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan was urging Mr. Gorbachev to tear down this wall. In his famous speech, urging Russia to open up. And it begs a question, does politics drive economics or does economics drive politics? And, here we are 30 years later where Mr. Trump is urging America, we will build a wall. A 180-degree about turn on integration and coordination and collaboration. When it comes to... perhaps I just want to make that as a backdrop to our broader conversation. But, when it comes to finding others and to achieving win-win outcomes, there is a huge emphasis in this conversation, not just our discussion this evening, but generally the conversation around economic relationships with others that emphasizes trade relationships. And what it ignores are three other critical components of economic connection. And that's the sharing of information, know-how, know-why, data, blueprints, brands, the movement of people all the way from tourists to engineers and eventually immigrants, and the movement of capital, which takes the shape of foreign aid, foreign loans, and eventually foreign portfolio or foreign direct investment. Brooks's point about a Huawei is made, or a phone has components from all over the world. I wonder what the local content, what the American content of a Huawei phone is. And I think that would be an interesting aspect on, you know, on this broader conversation of, well, it's just as easy as build a wall and we'll all be okay inside of this. And while all of that conversation is happening, we have the African Free Trade Agreement, which is trying to go in the exact opposite direction. If the early evidence from the East African community is anything to go by, what you want to achieve is the removal of artificial borders and barriers to integration and connectedness. The East African community has been, I would venture, in the last 5 or 10 years, a spectacular success of economic connection, and integration. And it goes in the opposite direction to the Build a Wall proposal.
Thanks for that, Adrian. George, I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond. Would you like to respond?
Please.
Yeah, and then just after George Brooks, I'm going to give you the opportunity as well. So, but after you, George, please.
Okay, the United States did not build a wall. China built a wall. The United States has been asking in 15 years of negotiation that they tear down the wall and permit free access of American goods to China. China has refused. The only thing that the United States did was not build a wall. Was essentially to say, look, China, if you're going to have limits, we will have our own limits. The United States maintains very strong free trade relations in North America. NAFTA is larger than in population than Europe, larger economically than Europe. We're very comfortable with free trade relations. We have free trade relations with many countries. But in the case of China, China built the wall. And it's been very successful in trying to portray itself as the victim, when the Americans, at least, regard them as the victimizer.
Brooks, your take on it, if you'd like to comment?
Yeah, let me just make a couple of observations. This conversation that we've been having, like so many other conversations about this, it assumes, in a way, that whatever there is now is what we have forever, and the relationships and the trade balances and all the rest of it, and trade flows and investment flows, are also for forever. And the point of this is that many, not all, but many of those job losses suffered in the old industrial heartland in the United States were not a function of imports. They were a function of Robbie the robot. The machinery is different. The manufacturing process is different. Machines don't take leave. They don't get drunk. They don't take sick leave. They don't wear out late in the afternoon. They don't need lunch breaks. They're designed to do what they're going to do, and they do it. If they're designed properly, they do it well. But they also cut out lots and lots of people who used to do that stuff. I once went to a Japanese steel plant. It had been designed as an integrated plant, and it was put together in a way which maximized the efficiencies of integrated operations and automation, and it went from about 300 people on a shift to 15. That's a big difference. And that has been lacking in many of the conversations about trade as a whole and the U.S.-China trade relationship. But a second point, and it's something that gets left out even more often, that even if the Chinese are engaging in various kinds of predatory practices and intellectual property misappropriation or theft, and even if the tariffs built into the system now by the United States are true and happen and have an effect, what it's doing is, for many companies, either thinking about diversifying their supply chain bases of operation, and in some cases already moving their procurement and manufacturing, because they may have seen the writing on the wall, to other places in Southeast Asia, and eventually perhaps to Africa as well. There are opportunities for countries that didn't have them before that are coming out of this clash. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't notice that change happens all the time. It isn't a static system. It isn't ordained in a particular way for forever. And we need to pick it apart a bit to see these changes as they happen. Remember, this big boom in China was not true 30 years ago. It didn't exist. It existed as a function of the change in Chinese political economy and the rush of foreign business people to invest in or procure in China, because there was this vast pool of efficient or high or skilled or industrious laborers aching for the opportunity to earn a better wage. Many of them had all kinds of different arrangements, whether it was franchise or partial assembly or full assembly. And now you'll see some of that moving, as it already has, to the Vietnams of this world, to the Indonesias of this world, the Sri Lankas and so forth. Look inside the latest pair of athletic shoes you bought, and you'll see a company, probably see that the thing was manufactured or assembled in a country you never would have associated with high-end running shoes 10 years ago.
Adrian, I mean, you made the point just now. And sorry, thank you for that, Brooks, because I think it adds a lot of color to what we're discussing this evening. Adrian, I mean, you make the point just now around, really speaking, what do markets need? They need the sharing of information, the movement of the people, and then ultimately the movement of capital. That's ultimately how, if you have a free area like that, then you have the best ideas finding capital and capital finding ideas, and that's how economies move forward, because then you have growth that happens. But ultimately, businesses do survive, and ultimately businesses do find their ways around these things. So let's assume that there's the tariffs that come in, let's assume there's protectionism, and we don't know the degree to what that'll happen. Surely companies just find their ways around these things.
Yeah, can I just put a quick qualification around the observation about the movement of people and goods?
Sure.
and qualify and emphasize that this has to be the functional movement of people, the functional movement of capital, because for every example of perhaps win-win economics, we could put up an example of lose-lose economics, and in the case of the movement of people, the transatlantic slave trade is a case in point. So we need to be very careful that it's not just we'll move people around and everything's going to be a fantastic result. We have to put that word functional ahead. And then from there, you're absolutely right. I would agree with the observation, both Brooks's observation and yours, that this is now, and if we advance our discussion 5 years or a decade, it'll be a new set of circumstances. Economic and political powers will have shifted. Industrial arrangements will have sorted themselves out in a new way. And it's the business of businesses to navigate that, and the task of CEOs and capital to allocate resources that they can work with that ever-shifting environment. And the stronger businesses, the more agile businesses, are the ones that will wrestle with this challenge and navigate and negotiate their way through it to a better place.
George, ultimately the Trump administration will run its course, and they would go and they would be replaced by a new administration in the United States. How do they deal with something like this? They would inherit almost these new tariffs, so to speak. How would they potentially deal with this then?
Well, I think we should go back to the Obama administration. The Obama administration was carrying out very similar talks with the Chinese, particularly on currency manipulation and things like that. Trump appears always impetuous and uncontrolled, but in fact, there was a logic here that had been unfolding since 2008, where the United was saying, look, we have to change the rules between us, at the same time as it was changing rules with Australia to open of markets. So this is not something that is absolutely alien from the American political system, or an oddity that Trump introduced. What we reached the point was, it was clear that the Chinese were not going to be able to, for their own internal political reasons,
I think they wanted to make a change, but could not make a sufficient change. And so the United States changed the rules on its own. By the way, I think calling this the trade war is a mistake. This is a recalibration. But I think the arguments that I've heard, you know, are very powerful, which is that one of the consequences of China's behavior, the American response, is the movement of production away from China to other low-wage, high-growth economies. We see that, for example, already in Ethiopia, where a good many things are being manufactured. So one of the consequences to the Chinese is that as they lose access to the American market on their terms, they lose their competitive advantage. And I think this is beneficial to the world. I mean, we spoke, somebody mentioned South Africa. South Africa is in a position to join in this early growth process and really develop. It's the Chinese have not simply been predatory in its relations to the United States. They've been desperate. They've been desperately holding on. And in the same instance, they've been locking down the movement of jobs functionally from point to point, from country to country. And I think one of the things that's happening now as a result of 2008 is a redefinition of the international economic system. So the question of, you know, if Trump is gone, will the United States, without concessions from China, move back? That's almost impossible. It was not just the Republicans. The Democrats were also very much on the Chinese case.
Well, I just want to thank all our guests this evening. That was Dr. Adrian Saville, CEO for Canon Asset Managers, Brooke Spector, former U.S. diplomat in Africa and East Asia, and associate editor today of the Daily Maverick, and George Friedman, chairman of Geopolitical Futures. Kenate Fortwane is in the Jazz Lounge for you in Cape Town, and Gauteng Caroline Steyn has an hour of winding down. Thanks for tuning into the Classic Business Show, which was brought to you by Altron Technology Partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit altron.com. Altron, there when it matters.